I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Andrew Solomon is with us this hour. His book, Far From the Tree, a bestseller and obviously read by so many, and he was with us when that book was first published. It's now in a young adult edition, How Children and Their Parents Learn to Accept One Another, Our Differences Unite Us. He spent 10 years with 300 different families, and the families had children who were autistic, who were dwarfs, who were deaf, who were schizophrenic, who were transgender, who were criminals. And the stories that he tells and the questions that he asks about our existence and our definition of family and our vertical lives and our horizontal lives, the stories that he tells about being a Jewish gay child in New York and growing up during a time when homosexuality was considered illegal, and how that defined his family life in some ways, in addition to a whole lot of love. He just asks some profound questions and tells some remarkable stories about family. Andrew's books have won over 50 awards. He's a writer and lecturer on psychology, politics, and the arts, the winner of the National Book Award, an activist in LGBT rights, mental health, and the arts, a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Medical Center, president of Penn American Center. In addition to Far From the Tree, he's written a number of other books, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. He studied Russian artists with the publication of the Ivory Tower Soviet Artists in a Time of Glasnost. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, has written for The New Yorker, Travel and Leisure, Art Forum. And he also writes very movingly about his family and his decision to have children during the course of writing this book. So we have a whole lot to talk about with him this hour, and we'll welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Andrew, a pleasure to talk to you again. Hi.
Well, what a pleasure it is to be here, and thank you for that generous introduction.
Thanks, Andrew. How's the family?
The family's very well indeed. We're all going to be together for my father's 90th birthday this weekend. So exciting times around here.
Yeah, we'll talk about the structure of your family in a moment because I found it very moving. Early in the book, this new one, writing this book, you say, addressed a sadness within you, and somewhat to your surprise, it largely cured it. This can go on for a while, but please address what the sadness was and how the book cured it.
Well, the book is really about how families who perceive themselves to be normal deal with children whom they perceive to be abnormal or exceptional in some profound way. And before I wrote the book, I had tended to blur the ideas of love and acceptance. And when my parents were slow to embrace what I felt was the reality that I was gay, I experienced it as a lack of love. And as I worked on this book, I realized that love is something that most parents feel for their children, obviously not all parents, but most parents, and that comes about fairly quickly after the child is born. But acceptance is a process, and it takes time, even when you aren't dealing with a child who is as different as many of the children I described, or indeed as the child I was. And as I wrote the book, I began to feel as though, okay, my parents always loved me, it just took them a while to accept me. And acceptance always requires time. And I became much less angry as a result of understanding that. And, you know, they got there. Would I have liked them to get there a lot faster? Yes, I would have. It would have been a great boon in my life. And as I look at parenthood itself, I think that there has to be a struggling toward acceptance. But I felt less angry when I realized how well the pattern of my own family fit in with the patterns of so many of the families
right.
I was interviewing.
And you also remind us that in the 1960s, when you were growing up, I think in 1963, when you were a young kid, Time magazine was talking about, you know, the evils of homosexuality. When you think about what our mindset was then, and for many, many years until now, there's been a big change.
Yes, Time magazine, I was born in 63, and in 66 published an article in which they said, even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. as such, it deserves no glamorization, no rationalization, and above all, no pretense that it is anything but a pernicious sickness. And really, one of the defining questions as I worked on this book was how we got from there to the point at which the Supreme Court found in favor of gay marriage on a national level. How did something so universally understood to be an illness and a crime and a sin come instead to be seen as an identity?
Mm-hmm.
And if the identity that I have emerged from that very dark place, then what other identities were there that were waiting to emerge themselves? And how could I chronicle that process?
And you've done it so well. Your parents would have said yes to an operation that would have made you straight?
Yes, I think my parents would have done that, and they would have done that in part because they would have perceived, accurately it must be said, that being gay was difficult and that this was not going to be an easy path. And I think most parents want to make their children's lives easier. But also, I think they felt that it was an embarrassment to have a child who was gay. It was a kind of difference with which they felt very uncomfortable, my mother in particular. But of course, when they imagined what it meant to be gay, they were imagining what it meant to be gay then. And what it meant to be gay then was, to some large extent, to be at the margins of your society, to not be accepted in many quarters, to not be welcomed in many instances, often not to find a partner, almost invariably not to have children. Mm-hmm. So the life from which they most wanted to protect me is actually not the life that I've ended up leading.
Thank goodness for that. And thank goodness you can be a father, because you write so beautifully about that. It must be so rewarding for you.
You know, I think that there are vulnerabilities that are associated always with having children and delights that are associated with it.
Right.
But for me, I spent years thinking I had to choose between being true to myself by emerging and acknowledging myself as a gay person and having a family. And those two things were in opposition, and the pain of having to choose between them was the greatest pain of my life. And now the world has changed, and indeed I am a father, and I think my fatherhood is infused, you know, despite occasional frustrations, but I think it's infused with a particular joy because it seemed so impossible for so long, and I feel newly surprised and newly amazed by it every day.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. Before we talk about vertical, horizontal, et cetera, I want to talk about, because this is also a theme that you've gone to many families where there's been great joy, but you've also experienced in your life, you know, kids on the bus who were taunting you and not having many friends, and a young deaf woman in the book who's sexually abused by her father, and other deaf children are at a higher rate than those who are not deaf, those who are dwarfs who are, you know, tossed around as toys. There's a great deal of pain and bullying involved with many of the children and the families that you have written about, isn't there?
Oh, a great deal, absolutely. I feel like each of the conditions that I was writing about contains two forms of difficulty. One is its inherent kind of medicalized difficulty. So you can make as much as you want about social acceptance of people with schizophrenia, but it's still not going to be a pleasant experience to have a condition that entails believing all the time that you know, voices are instructing you to do terrible things and are pulling you to shreds. Schizophrenia is an unpleasant experience. But in addition to the inherent difficulty, there's a lot of social difficulty. So if you are a dwarf, for example, and you can never reach anything on the high shelves of the grocery stores, and there's no provision made for anyone to help you, that's a social problem. And if you're a dwarf and you get stared at and taunted on the street, that's a social problem. And the difficulty arises when we apply medical solutions to social problems, or to some degree, social solutions to medical problems. So to say, I hate being a dwarf because I hate being stared at, really isn't to say I hate being a dwarf. It's to say I hate the way society views dwarfs and how people feel entitled to treat me.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried in the book to tease apart, you know, these conditions are difficult. I'm not suggesting that it would be really fun for all of us to have autism or Down syndrome or any of the conditions that I wrote about. But I think we could create a much, much more tolerant society in which those differences, instead of being so heavily stigmatized and so burdened with shame, became instead people's simple definition of who they are.
Mm-hmm. I just cringed when I was reading about what some people do to not be dwarfs anymore, the painful operation. I didn't know that was done, Andrew.
Yes, people go through limb lengthening, and it involves years and years of very intrusive surgery, often results in neurological damage. It means that people spend their adolescence in a wheelchair. I won't describe all of the medical details, but effectively, your bones are broken in many places, and as they knit together, are broken again over and over and over and over again. So the question is whether you're making the symptoms disappear because you want to give someone a better life, or whether you're making them disappear because you're ashamed of them, and whether, if it's shame, you can resolve it the other way. I mean, I probably wouldn't, if I had a child who was a dwarf, go for limb lengthening. On the other hand, if I had a child who was deaf, I probably would get that child a cochlear implant. And one of the things I wanted to write about in the book, which cochlear implant is a device that allows sound information to travel to the brain bypassing the structures of the ear. And one of the things I wrote about in the book is that everyone has a different standard for what they would correct and what they would learn to accept and perhaps even celebrate. And that while some things clearly need to be corrected and changed, and some things clearly are unchangeable and need to be accepted and celebrated, an awful lot falls in a foggy middle.
Right. I was so struck by your attending the National Association for the Deaf, and at one point you say in the book that you wished you were deaf at that because everybody seemed to be joyful.
Yes, I had started off writing about deafness. That was how the whole book began, thinking, oh, well, it's a terrible disability. These poor people, they can't hear. Can we do anything for them? And then as I got deeper and deeper into the lives of deaf people, I realized it's actually quite a beautiful culture organized around the use of sign language. And at that NAD meeting, I remember walking in, and there were all these conversations flying off the ends of everyone's hands, and all these people rushing to give one another these huge embraces. And I did think at that moment, not that I wished I couldn't hear, but that I wished I were part of that rather beautiful society into which I had received a window, but which I could never truly join because I didn't share the life experience of its members.
So this brings us to a discussion of this vertical experience and horizontal experience.
So I've posed that there are two kinds of identities. There are vertical identities that are passed down generationally from parent to child. So your ethnicity, your nationality, frequently your religion, usually your language. And parents may have these things in common with their children, and therefore teach their children a sense of pride in them from an early stage. So you can say that it is still easier in the United States to be a white Christian than it is to be a African-American Muslim, but there is not some movement underway to ensure that the next generation of children born to African-Americans come out with blonde hair and blue eyes and get integrated into their local church. People say, this is who we are, and this is how we see ourselves, and this is how we struggle through. But there are also what I call horizontal identities. Horizontal because they aren't shared between parents and children. They're conditions that are usually quite defining that children have and their parents don't share, like deafness and dwarfism and autism and all of the others that you listed in the introduction, and many, many others besides that wouldn't fit in the book. And what I wanted to understand is how do people who have a family that thinks that the way they are is aberrant and probably undesirable, how do they come to a coherent sense of identity? And if their parents are always focused on how to cure them or how to fix them, how do they reach a point of self-acceptance? And how can they lead their parents or be led by their parents into a larger acceptance in the family and in society?
How did you do that?
You know, I think partly I did it by writing chunky books that were about the topic, but I think also just by insisting on who I was and effectively saying, if you don't love me as who I am, then you don't actually love me at all, and pushing it to a kind of breaking point. But it was a big investigation for me. And the reason I've done a young adult version of this book is that the original version is very much about how do parents come to a point of acceptance. And this version, though it's also just a shorter version that many adults may wish to read, but it also looks more at the question of, okay, you're a kid who's different. How do you get to a point of feeling okay about who you are? And what can you expect reasonably of your family as you do so?
Mm-hmm. And how often did you find that parents were able to help their children achieve that horizontal identity by having them meet other dwarfs, people who were deaf, people who were going through a similar life experience, and how many of the young people had to find all of that by themselves?
Well, I'd start by saying that community is invaluable, and that the process through which these kids discover community, or these families discover community, can't be overestimated in its importance. In some instances, you have parents who are very aware. They discover, I have a child who's deaf. I should meet a lot of deaf adults so my child grows up with some deaf role models. I have a child who's a dwarf. I should get involved with the Little People of America so that my child develops a sort of sense of pride. But a lot of the time, the parents don't really understand that that's necessary or that it would be helpful, and so they don't pursue it, and the kids themselves have to come along and pursue it on their own. I've just yesterday come back from going to Gay Family Week in Providence, in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which I really was going to for research. We took our son along. I was kind of shocked when we got there to realize that he's growing up in a world in which it's very unusual to have two dads. It's not stigmatized. No one has teased or bullied him about it. But he was kind of relieved to get to a context in which that wasn't so exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, oh, here I am, I've written this whole book, and yet as a parent, it still didn't occur to me, my child has an identity that's a little different and needs a community organized around that identity.
Interesting. This takes us to another place, but I was also struck, which I can understand fully, when your son was born, tell us this story, that they thought he needed a CAT scan, there was something wrong here, and you've done years and years of research on all of this, and yet you realized that you sure didn't want something to be wrong with him, to have to be the father of a child who was going to have to encounter some of what you had written about.
Well, the day after he was born, the pediatrician came into our hospital room and said that he wasn't extending his legs correctly. And I said, oh. And she said, that could be indicative of severe neurological damage. And I said, what? And she said, and insofar as he's doing so, he's doing it asymmetrically, which could suggest a mass in his brain. And by the way, he has a very large head and should be tested for hydrocephalus. And I felt my whole being kind of draining onto the floor. And as we went around to the CAT scan and the MRI and the other X-ray section and for an arterial blood draw, I thought, here I've been writing this book about how all these parents have found meaning in having children whom the larger society would see as damaged, and yet I don't want to join their number. But I realized that I had the feeling that I think all parents have had since the beginning of time of wanting to be able to protect my child. But I realized if he had any of the things we were testing him for, that those would be his identity as well as his burden and his illness, and that if they became his identity, that they would enter into and become a part of my identity, and that ultimately I would understand them very differently. In fact, it turned out that he was fine, and when I asked the pediatrician 5 hours later what she thought had been going on in the morning when she gave me all of this terrifying news, she said he had probably had a cramp in his leg. But it was kind of revelatory to go through all of that. And if I hadn't been working on this book, I would never have seen that duality, that I could want to save my child, but that I could also be open to changing my identity.
Andrew Solomon is our guest this hour. His latest book is Far From the Tree. It's the young adult edition, How Children and Their Parents Learn to Accept One Another, Our Differences Unite Us. We're welcoming phone calls for him if you would like to join the conversation. Interestingly, we were talking about autism. I want to spend some time talking about autism because we spoke earlier this week, as you'll recall, that Ron Suskind, whose son is autistic, and they did a film about him and his connection with and memorization of all the Disney movies, and that's how they learned to communicate when he was a little bit older, and he went on to be nominated the film for an Academy Award. I want to talk about autism a little bit. And he also writes, you know, transgender and dwarfs. We can talk more about that. Schizophrenia, criminals. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Disabled children. I know there are many of you listening who have this in your family. And so we're interested in hearing your stories as well and how you come to acceptance and come to help those with horizontal identities, or if you are somebody with one of those identities, whether or not you were completely accepted. We would love to hear from you. And here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is ideas@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, Andrew is with us now. Let's go to phone calls for this wonderful author. 800-486-8655 is the number. Lynn in Eau Claire is our first caller for you, Andrew. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show, as usual. I have a son, an adapted son, who is a 35-year-old Ojibwa. He's been in my life since he was 9 years old. He is my son, and he is... He's nobody's child. He doesn't have, I tell him he's no different than the rest of us. He can do whatever it is his heart desires. He was born in this country. You know, the same thing that you tell all your children, but every day I see him denied the opportunities that my other natural-born children can have. And he's my son. He's a beautiful man. And am I lying to my child, telling him he is no different?
Well, thank you for calling with that moving story, which actually is tied more into the book I'm working on now than the one I've already done, so I'd love to talk to you about it more offline. I don't think that you're lying to your son in saying that he has the same status in your heart and your experience as everyone else has. He may be treated differently by the outside world, and one of the complexities, I think, of the family relationships we deliver is that what becomes our normal continues to be not as normal to the larger world, and the hatred and prejudice and divisiveness that have surfaced in this country, especially in these last 6 months, is terrifying to behold. So I think you have to give him a sense of being loved, but not pretend that he doesn't face those difficulties. It will be hard for him to feel that you don't see what he goes through, and to be able to say, to me, you are the most beautiful child anyone could want, and for you, I know that you are going to face difficulties that I have never had to face, and tell me what I can do to help make you strong enough to battle them down.
Mm. Lynn, I'll get you on hold so we can get in contact information and Andrew can get a hold of you for his next book, okay?
Thank you much.
Yeah, thanks very much. What are you working on now, Andrew?
I'm working on a book about expanding ideas of family. So it includes chapters on adoption, especially interracial adoption, on working mothers and more involved fathers, on interracial families, on gay families, on single parents by choice or otherwise, multi-parent families, and so on.
Mm, great. Thanks for the call, Lynn. We go to Aiden in Green Bay. Hi, Aiden.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say thank you for writing this book. I'm actually a straight white male, but my father was someone who suffered through a lot of mental illnesses and addictions and isn't in my life anymore. But this book is really, I think, universal and important, not just for people who, you know, feel different or feel weird, but for also just the rest of us who are trying to figure out what it means to, you know, for me, my biggest struggle is to figure out what it means to be a man or, you know, how to not live the way that my father did. And I think, in a way, this book is going to be really helpful to me. And I just wanted to say thank you for writing something that is so universal to so many of us.
Well, thank you so, so much for saying that. Yes, the idea is that the book, by looking at certain extreme circumstances, reveals altogether what the relationships between parents and children can be. And I'm honored that you've understood that and very, very moved by your words. Thank you.
Let's spend a little bit more time talking then about the families that you visited with, spent time with, where there is mental illness.
So I was looking mostly at, for that book, the situation of families who, in which the parents didn't have mental illness, but the children did,
right.
How the parents came to grips with that. So there's obviously also the question brought up by the caller, by Aiden, about having a mentally ill parent. You know, you can do a lot of things to make the world friendlier, but you can't actually erase the difficulty and pain that tends to be attached to mental illness. And for parents, there's the problem, because those illnesses tend to set in later on. I mean, some very young children have psychiatric disturbances, but mostly they surface in adolescence or young adulthood, that the parent remembers this child as well and thinks, oh, if I could only remove this illness, I would have my well child back. And often the reality is that the well child no longer exists and that there have been fundamental changes in whatever it is, brain or psychic structure, and that now they have to deal with a somewhat different person than they started out with, which doesn't mean that you would love that person any less. It just means that there are going to be intense challenges to face down. Now, all of that is complicated by the stigma attached to mental illness. And so the question is how you get through and manage to be the best parent you can to a child who has needs that are not the needs that you thought that child was going to have.
And what about the understanding we have? It's interesting when you look at, you know, dwarfism, even deafness, certainly autism and mental illness. I don't know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of resource, a lot of attention paid to what could be done maybe to, and then this brings up the question, the philosophical question of, do we want to have a world where there is no deafness? Do we want to have a world with no dwarfs? But we probably want to have a world without mental illness, right? Have we paid enough attention to dealing with that, to helping people who have it, children who have it?
Well, my experience was that, you know, there are people who have mental illness who've managed to do very well, but I didn't meet anyone who said to me about the major mental illnesses, oh, I'm really glad I had this illness. I would never want to imagine my life without it.
Right.
I met people who had, for example, autism who did say that. They said, this is who I am, and this is how my mind works, and I like my own mind, and I like who I am, and I wouldn't want to be cured or fixed for what I have, but not with schizophrenia and not the subject of my previous book, which was depression and bipolar illness. So those, I think, are very problematical conditions that carry just this enormous inherent pain. But if you have one of those conditions, there are a lot of ideas to come from it. And I was very struck by an interview I did with an extremely well-known writer who went in pseudonymously to protect her brother. Her brother had schizophrenia, and she said, you know, my brother and I have the same mind and the same imagination, but I know it's not real, so I publish it, and I've won a Pulitzer Prize
for
it.
Oh, my gosh.
And he thinks it is real, and so he's living permanently in a psychiatric facility, and that young man has killed himself. So the question of what the borderline is between, I mean, I think all mental illnesses are useful in small quantities. And then, you know, schizophrenia is connected to imagination, depression to a certain kind of insight, mania to inspiration. But I think all of them in their more extreme versions need to be addressed and need to be taken seriously. And the attempts to suggest somehow that psychiatric care is a kind of fun luxury for the privileged part of society and doesn't belong elsewhere is a very pernicious idea. Everyone deserves to have psychiatric and mental health as well as physical health.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Daniel in Michigan. Hi, Daniel.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. The reason I'm calling is I have five children, and we're living in Ecuador. I'm in Upper Peninsula right now. But we moved there specifically. We have a 13-year-old son that was born with autism. And gentleman there was talking about vertical and horizontal. And one of the things, the reason we moved to Ecuador is because we have been using Chinese medicine and also homeopathy specifically to cure. And one of the things that every human being, you know, every child is born, acquires, you know, an inherited pathology from the parent, which is, I think, one thing you can add to your list of the vertical things that we get from our family. And that acquired pathology severely affects autistic kids. And so I studied homeopathy myself, but I had a world-renowned homeopath do my son's case, and it has, I mean, he's been on one remedy for 5 years, and it has incredibly affected, you know, his functioning, his normalcy and everything. And with homeopathy, we were for like 80%. You know, cured completely of all autism. But I mean, there's a lot of factors with autism, but I just wanted to comment that, the vertical, one of the things you've really got to consider in the vertical things we inherited besides religion and language and all that is inherited pathology.
I mean, all right, Andrew.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of inherited pathology. Autism is largely not an inherited pathology, though there is some evidence that people who've got semi-autistic tendencies will sometimes get together and will have children with more pronounced autistic tendencies. I think, you know, all of us pass along some good and some bad to our children. I call to mind the arguments that took place, I guess, almost 10 years ago now when Bree Walker, who was a newscaster in California, was having children. She had a condition called lobster claw syndrome in which she'd been born with very deformed hands, which had been corrected largely through surgery. She was extremely beautiful. She was a remarkable TV personality. She is, in fact, beautiful and a remarkable TV personality. She's an extremely accomplished woman, and there was a kind of public outcry after she said that she was having children, even though there was a possibility they would be born with this, about, you know, how could you do that to children and deliberately create children with disabilities? And I thought, you know, we all bring children into mixed circumstances. We don't say, okay, poverty is a horrible thing for growing children. Poor people shouldn't be allowed to reproduce. And we don't say, okay, this person is, given to depression and shouldn't be allowed to have children. I think there's a judgmental streak that comes into the society about what it's okay to pass along and what it's not okay to pass along. And I think it's a moral decision that's made by prospective parents. I can pass along these things that will be great. There is a potential that I will pass along these other things that will be terrible. How do I decide under those circumstances whether I will choose to have my own biological children? And I think it's a very personal decision and one that it's really not useful or appropriate to question. Mm. So I don't know where the caller's son's autism originated. And while I haven't seen particularly good results for homeopathy, if that's working, you know, go with what works. It's not like there are a lot of other addresses to place. I mean, a lot of other means that to address autism. But I think in terms of what you pass along, you know, it's sort of the heartbreak of much of parenting is the feeling of, oh, no, that's exactly the way that I am, and it caused me so much pain, and there he is doing that same thing again. It's there even if your child doesn't have any extreme condition.
It's true. Let's talk a little bit, though, about how things, we were talking about the 1960s when you were born and how things have changed. With the news yesterday that this is a ways down the road, but they've been experimenting with mice and can change genes so that certain illnesses won't happen if you carry a gene for a certain illness. I would imagine that, you know, it's not inconceivable that 10 years from now or 20 years from now, you can go in and mix up a gene and change it so that all of what you have written about won't appear any longer. And then we would have a world maybe that's without, I don't know, schizophrenia, without dwarfism, without deafness, probably with gay people because that's all changed, right? But, I mean, it's a brave new future. It's an unknown thing, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think there's a real possibility of trying to erase differences without considering what value they bestow. So it's not that I think, you know, the environmental crisis is necessarily going to be solved by someone with Down syndrome. But I think if you start trying to standardize humanity beyond a certain point, that there are losses involved. On the other hand, people emerge with different forms of difference, and diversity takes on new shapes. I mean, there are lots of really serious illnesses that we've learned to vaccinate against or to cure when they occur, and people don't die from them, and that's great. I think people just have to be awake. You know, if you're going to come up with a cure for dwarfism, maybe you should talk to some dwarfs and find out what their lives are like and find out how they understand themselves and find out what they would wish for themselves. If you're going to try to cure dwarfism, then are you going to try to cure gayness? I think actually that if a cure came along and it were simple and quick, that a lot of the social progress we've seen would vanish and that a lot of parents would opt for it. Not all of them, perhaps, but many of them would say, I just think it will be easier for us all if my child is straight. And some people, of course, are driven toward that by religious values. Yeah. So I think we can erase a lot of human diversity, and I think in doing so we limit what it is to be human. Now, having said that, on a grand scale, I feel like nobody should be forced to endure a great deal of personal pain just to argue a political point unless that person wishes to do so. So to say to a little baby, well, you know, we could cure what you have, but we're not going to because we believe in the diversity of the world and you'll just have to live with it in pain and suffering, you know, that's not such a great thing to do. You have to assess again what the child will feel initially, what the child will feel across a lifetime, what you as a parent will feel across a lifetime. I think the likelihood that we will reach the point of being able to wipe out all the conditions in my book or all the conditions that make people diffuse and diverse are very slim. And I look, for example, at someone I interviewed who had cystic fibrosis, and she had an identity based on cystic fibrosis, and she wrote about cystic fibrosis beautifully, and she had a philosophy of life that had come from her experiences, and there was a lot that she gained from having cystic fibrosis. But she died when she was 26 years old, and if we could come up with a treatment or cure for cystic fibrosis, we would lose the literature she created, but we would actually have her with us. Mm-hmm. There are complicated balances to figure out.
Thanks, Daniel, for your call. Let's go to Sherry in Mequonago. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Kathleen. Wonderful show, and Andrew, love your insights. I'd like to share a message of hope with the listeners. Based on my own journey through my MS and my son's journey through Tourette's and how I use the tools I learned in my own life to help him navigate through his stuff that he had to navigate through. So a condensed version of the backdrop is I was diagnosed late 20s, very aggressive MS, wheelchair-bound, short time frame, with a lot of physical manifestation that was pretty graphic to watch as far as jerking limbs and that kind of stuff. And so I was thrown into a situation where I had a lot of people staring at me as I would go out in public. And I had made myself go out in public intentionally so I could get buffered, mentally buffered to that reaction that people have to you when your body displays weird stuff. So fast forward, and I found answers for myself. I didn't end up in a wheelchair, so that's all positive, wonderful end story for me. But fast forward to my son, who had Tourette's came on when he was actually, it displayed some symptoms when he was in kindergarten already, but the doctor said, well, boys have tics, don't worry about it, blah, blah, blah. And then in fifth grade, it came on full bore, and it was like full bore Tourette's, where you see the coprolalia, where there's the swearing that goes on. He had other manifestations of it as well. One example was echolalia, which I had a wonderful time with because I would say things like, "My mom is wonderful," and he'd repeat it back to me, and then we both laugh. So, bottom line is what I used to help him through this was I used the lessons I learned in my own life. I took him with me every place I went. And that meant if I went to Walmart, we're going to Walmart, and understand, I explained to him, you have to understand that people are going to stare at you, but it's not because they're trying to be cruel all the time. Sometimes it's because they don't understand, and there's a fear factor based on they don't understand what's going on with your body. So recognize that you can stare back at them if they're staring at you, or you can totally ignore them, or you can just point blank say to them, I have Tourette's, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, and then give him the choice of how to handle the situation. So then moving forward, I made him join a boys' football team, talked to the coach first, explained the dynamic. I said, it's pretty aggressive stuff. He's being heavily medicated, so he's gained some weight, and so this is not going to be a your star football player. But I think it's important that we instill those life lessons in our children so that they can navigate these conditions more effectively. So the coach was all for it. He says, that sounds great. I said, would you mind if I talk to all of the parents and football players on that team before the first practice? He said, I think that's a wonderful idea. So that's what I did. And then I explained to all of them, and I said, if you have questions, you can feel free to ask me or ask Eric straight up so that you understand, you know, what he's going through. And at the end of that first year, he won the sportsmanship award. So and he wasn't a wonderful football player, but the team embraced what he had to go through because they understood it better. So the point being is that if we help our kids understand some tools, I think, to navigate a little bit better, it's helpful. I did the same thing when I went to, when he was entering into a new school. I would ask to have all the teachers meet, and I would talk to all of them, explain the condition in greater depth, and give them an opportunity to ask questions of what it was like and what they had to navigate, and ask them also to be patient with him, because I understand that having vocal tics, physical tics are hard enough, but vocal tics in a classroom is very disruptive. and I asked them to look at this through the eyes of him. How would you feel if you had this yourself and you could do nothing to control it?
Mm-hmm. Let's get a response from Andrew. Andrew.
Well, I think what you've described is really wonderful parenting, and I think it's wonderful because you've really gone from two angles at once. On the one hand, you've said to him, when we walk through Walmart, people are going to stare at you, you are different, and you're going to have to learn how to negotiate it. Here are some tips, but it's really something you have to learn for yourself. And at the same time, you've said to him, I'm going to do all I can to cushion your situation in places like school or on the football team where there might otherwise be a level of kind of discomfort and abuse that would make your life a lot worse. And I think that the path that all parents of children with significant or even insignificant differences have to negotiate is how much do I go along just saying, don't worry, everything's fine, which is sort of a fiction. How much do I say, this is a terrible tragedy, what are you ever going to do? How much do I let you encounter the real world and say, you just have to buck up and deal with it, buddy? How much do I go and try to fix everything? And I think people make mistakes in every one of those directions. I think there are parents who over-helicopter disabled children, and then those children are very ill-equipped when they finish in the educational system and have to live in the world. And I think there are obviously parents who don't give their children enough protection and resilience because they're too overwhelmed, and they don't really create a safe world for those children to gain material confidence. Mm. So without having been in your house and seen what you're doing, I would say it sounds like you're doing it just exactly right.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Sherry, thanks for the call. There's another football story in the book. Isn't there a young man who's deaf who plays football?
Baseball.
Baseball, sorry. Yeah. How could I forget? I'm a baseball family. Baseball, yes.
It was a deaf kid named Rory Osbrink who became a real champion baseball player. And he was deaf, and he read lips very well, and his speech is really very good. But when he was accepted into a major football school, and I'm trying to remember which one it was, but one of the big state universities, he went down to meet with the coach. And the coach basically was so patronizing and sort of used such a kind of, you know, he did this exaggerated speech, which is actually not easier to lip read. It's much harder to lip read. And he it didn't really look him in the eye. And he said, well, you'll just have to write down your questions on a pad. And Rory in that moment decided this is not what I'm going to do. And he went and applied to Gallaudet, which is the deaf university in D.C. And he went there and he now teaches there. And he really, I mean, I wasn't there when he was in his football, in his baseball playing heyday, but he really played well enough so that he could have been a league player. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a tragedy for him to discover that that world of sports was going to be so intolerant of him and of his differences.
Mm-hmm. Until I was reading the story, actually aloud to my husband last night because I found it fascinating. Tell the story of, because it goes into oralism and sign and when you can learn language and how we used to treat people who were deaf. Alexander Graham Bell, what a story that was. I was so struck by it, Andrew.
Well, Alexander Graham Bell, whom, of course, we know most of all, I think, for inventing the telephone, actually had a deaf wife, and he had a kind of paranoid hysteria that there was going to become a dominant wave of deafness in the United States and a deaf breed of American. And he went to great lengths to try to get deafness eradicated and to look at the idea that it could be passed along, but particularly to insist that all deaf people had to learn to read lips and to speak so that they could function in the mainstream world. Now, lip reading is a very complicated skill, and some people have a natural talent for it, and some people don't, and some people have a little bit of residual hearing that allows them to do much better with it, and other people don't. And creating oral speech is a sort of impossible gymnastics a lot of the time for people who haven't been able to hear language and who don't know what sounds they are supposed to be producing. And so he really brought about this change in deaf education in the United States, which had taken place in sign language since the early 19th century and started the movement toward oralism in which children would have their hands slapped with a ruler if they were signing in class. And the reality is that what this did was not to make them more verbal and comprehensible in English, but to make them have less understanding of language altogether. There are language centers in the brain. If they aren't activated relatively early on by relatively fluent language, they essentially become inactive and cannot be activated again. And so the decision at the so-called Congress of Milan, at which Alexander Rambaud was a major player, to get deaf people away from their own culture and away from their own language was a terrible one. If you've learned sign language fluently, which comes readily to people who are deaf, you can then learn English or whatever other language as a second language and may achieve some fluency in it. But if you prevent children from learning the language that is intuitively available to them, what you end up with is not people who think and function in English, but people who are challenged in thinking and functioning altogether because of the lack of language they've acquired.
And it's Alexander Graham Bell, of all people, right?
Yeah.
Ironic. Andrew Solomon is our guest. The book is Far From the Tree, How Children and Their Parents Learn to Accept One Another, Our Differences Unite Us. Our number is, you have time for a couple more phone calls, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We'll go to more of you in a moment after this here on the Ideas Network. And we return to phone calls for Andrew. Kent in Monona. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing?
Good, Ken. How are you?
I'm doing well. I just wanted to first congratulate you on your upcoming retirement here. It's very exciting, though I will miss you.
Thanks, Kent.
I guess I had a question for your guest. When I was a kid back in the late 80s, I was diagnosed with ADHD, and I was on Ritalin or Adderall or various variations on those for probably about 15, 20 years of my life. I don't think... I've since gotten off of them, and I don't show any symptoms of ADHD, and I know that there was a lot of misdiagnosis historically of ADD in children, especially in the 80s and 90s, the Ritalin generation, I've heard they called. So I was kind of wondering, what are the implications for misdiagnosis amongst kids these days, and is that still pretty common where kids will get medicated for something they aren't really suffering from?
Deeply political question. At the moment, the likelihood that you will be diagnosed for ADD or ADHD and treated with medication is, I think, almost twice as high if you are living in a poverty-stricken part of the country as it is if you're living in a more prosperous area. Does that suggest that poor people are more likely to have ADD? You know, maybe in some instances having ADD made it hard for them to hold down jobs and earn a lot of money, but by and large what it indicates is that there are fewer resources to support those children and that schools have less patience with them and that parents are less able to stand up to a diagnosis, an amateur diagnosis made by the school system. So I think it's... tremendously important that we recognize that. Misdiagnosis happens all the time. It's why everyone should get second and third and fourth opinions to figure out what the syndrome is that's affecting their child. And over-medication is frequent. I mean, there are children who benefit enormously from ADD medications. I think they can be tremendously helpful and that it would be a tragedy and a disaster to cease to use them now that we've arrived there. But there are many children who are put on the wrong medication, too much medication, or who don't really need to be on medication at all. What they really need is a greater level of personal attention. And I think the frequency with which those children are misdiagnosed and mistreated points to a failure of our health system, but also of our education system, and also of our system of social welfare and our lack of resources for less privileged people.
Mm. Thank you very much, Kent, for the call. And Andrew, thank you so much. It's really delightful to speak with you, and your book is important.
Well, I'm so honored to be here on your penultimate week, and only wish you were staying on the air so I could come back again.
Oh, thanks, Andrew. Well, I'll listen to you. You'll be on the air with somebody else.
I will look forward to that. And listeners, if anyone wants to get in touch with me, I'm available at andrewsolomon.com.
Andrewsolomon.com. Great. Andrew, thank you. Andrew Solomon, the book is Far From the Tree. It's the young adult edition, and we thank him. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing the program and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Be with you on Monday. We'll have all things political and some special guests coming up by last week on the air here at WPR.
Marquette Neighborhood Music Festivals present the Central Park Sessions. The concerts will be on Wednesday and Thursday evenings in Madison Central Park. Touring musicians and local groups will perform throughout the summer. WPR is pleased to support music that brings a neighborhood together. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.